You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, staffing shortages in the state prison system are leading to lockdowns and poor conditions for incarcerated people and a difficult working situation for employees. We'll find out more coming up. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a Green Bay Packers legend who's bringing his series of children's books.
Following experience, being a friend, words to live by Donald Driver on his journey toward becoming a member of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame, and a children's author whose books have now been adapted for the stage by the Marcus Performing Arts Center and First Stage in Milwaukee. Driver says the idea for his book series started simply at bedtime.
And it started with my kids, telling them stories that night, just kind of walking through the process. And the first book I wrote was Quickie Makes the Team, all about a little kid that wasn't the biggest kid in the world, but just had the heart to play the game that he loved.
That first book contained a lesson from his own childhood.
It's not about how big you are, it's about how big your heart is. Then you can go and accomplish all the things that you want to do.
Next was a book about perseverance.
Next thing you know, it was Quickie Handles a Loss, right? Everything we go through in life, we will lose something. It's just depending on what that loss is, right? We may fail a test, we may lose a game, we may lose a loved one. But regardless of what we do, we keep pushing on.
And if you do that, you can make your dreams come true.
And then the next one, Quickie Goes to the Big Game. We all dream of accomplishing something big in our lives. And if you have a dream, then you follow it.
The main character in the books is Quickie, who's based on Driver himself. Donald's path to football stardom wasn't easy as a seventh-round draft pick of the Green Bay Packers.
My biggest thing was just to make the team.
Oh, he made the team. And that was just the beginning.
But as time went on, you start getting closer and closer to records, and you start thinking that maybe I could be one of the best receivers to ever play for the Green Bay Packers, if not the best, right? And I did. I started to chase those goals, and all of a sudden, I was breaking records.
When Driver retired after 14 seasons with the Packers, he held the franchise records for receptions and receiving yards. Pretty impressive when you consider his number 80 jersey was also worn by NFL Hall of Famer James Lofton.
And he says, I wore the number for a long period of time, but you made the number. And for a Hall of Famer to give you that much credit after all the things that he's done with the Packers, something that I appreciate for a very long time.
In retirement, Driver won season 14 of Dancing with the Stars, wrote a series of children's books, and now he's the cultural ambassador for the Marcus Performing Arts Center in Milwaukee.
I love theater. I love performing arts. And I just wanted to get more Black and Brown people in those seats. And I've always dreamed of Quickie becoming a play.
For the Marcus Performing Arts Center and First Stage to turn Driver's books into a play, entitled Dream Quickie Dream, they had to find the perfect playwright, Gloria Bond Clooney.
She didn't know me from Adam and Eve, especially not playing football. She was like, I don't really know who he is. And then she found out I was on Dance with the Stars, and she was like, I knew that was him, right? So that's when we got connected.
And when Donald saw his books become Dream Quickie Dream on the stage, he was amazed.
Because they portrayed it to the T. After the first show, I had the pleasure of just sitting down with the cast and told them, thank you. Thank you for telling my story through your eyes. And it was amazing.
Jeff Frank is artistic director at First Stage, and he thinks the play contains an important message for the whole community.
The play really ends with an opportunity, you know, for the audience to ask, you know, what are your dreams? If you had a dream for yourself, a dream for your community, what is it? Right? And believe in it and get after it. Put the work in to make it happen.
And Kevin Galinto, president and CEO of the Marcus Performing Arts Center, says what made this production so special is Donald himself.
It allows someone to see themselves because they're familiar with Donald, and it makes the story more personal.
And so Driver says he hopes people who come to see the play leave with the same simple message that's guided him through his own amazing journeys.
If you have a dream, follow it. Don't let anyone tell you you can't reach your dreams.
For more on Donald Driver, his children's books, and the stage production of Dream Quickie Dream, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Instagram. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, several Wisconsin prisons and jails have been in lockdown for as long as 7 months, and inmates and their families have reported inhumane, unsanitary, and unsafe conditions, including extended isolation and withheld medical care. Coming up, we'll talk to a criminal justice reform advocate about how lockdown conditions are affecting incarcerated people. But first, a reporter who's been covering Wisconsin corrections gives us the rundown on what's happening in the Waupun and Green Bay correctional institutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know anyone who's serving time in a prison or working as a corrections officer in a prison that's in lockdown? Have you experienced it yourself? Do you have questions about what's happening in Waupun, Green Bay, or other prisons and jails? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mario Caron is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch, as well as a New York Times local investigations fellow examining Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. Mario, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What does it mean when we say prisons are on lockdown? What does that mean? How does that differ from normal prison life?
Yeah, so it's a good question and a good place to start. So lockdowns really refer to the fact that prisoners are confined to their cells for longer periods of time than typical. Now, of course, when we think about prisons, we think of people being confined in cells. But the reality is that for many prisons, there's activities, there's programs to do during the day. There are, opportunities to get out for recreation. There is timely access to medical care. But when we're talking about a lockdown, which the Department of Corrections sometimes called modified movement, that means that people are really spending an extended amount of time in their cells. So at one prison, Waupun Prison, which I wrote about quite extensively, this can look like being confined in a cell up to 24 hours a day. Irregular showers, irregular opportunities for recreation, even getting clean clothes has been delayed. So it's really something that has disrupted the daily lives and the routines of many of the prisoners incarcerated there. But there are even more, concerning or potentially alarming risks involved in a lockdown, such as not getting timely access to medical care.
Now, a lockdown, I would imagine, is usually a short-term thing. How long has lockdown been going on in, for example, Waupun?
Yeah, it's another good question. So lockdowns, yes, they typically are done in an emergency situation. I mean, this can be if there's an outbreak of violence or something disruptive at a prison. Over the long weekend, people can be confined to their cells, and maybe the prison guards will do a search of the facility to find contraband. So it really is usually an emergency short-term situation. At Waupun, for example, however, we're talking about a lockdown that's been going on 7 months. And just for a bit of context, in 1983, there was a riot at Waupun Prison where prisoners took control of one portion of the prison, took hostages, set fires, stuff that is relatively more serious than what we're hearing about today. And it was locked down for only 3 days. And so 3 days versus a 7 month lockdown that we're seeing now is quite the difference.
And the big story here, or a big part of the story, is the cause of the lockdowns. Why are they happening?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and one that has been surprisingly tricky to try to pin down. So the Department of Corrections, for its part, has said that the lockdown at Waupun was caused by threatening behavior, assaultive behavior. We weren't given many details. I wasn't given, as a reporter, many details of what that actually looked like, but I was told that was the reason for it, that there were safety and security concerns. I was also told that it had nothing to do with short staffing initially, that it wasn't attributable to that. Well, in the months since, the Department of Corrections has changed some of its statement and now acknowledges that short staffing is part of the cause, is part of the reason why they cannot lift the lockdown and why we're going on 7 months in the same sort of typical condition.
And Mario, in your piece, you talk about some of the numbers on staffing, and they are very stark, very striking. Can you tell us how short-staffed Waupun and other correctional institutions are?
Yeah, sure can. And also, to set the table, short staffing and vacancies is a problem that Wisconsin public agencies are facing nearly across the board, although it does seem to be most acute in prisons and in jails. So we're talking about system-wide, we're talking about a 32% vacancy rate, roughly around there, and that's in the prison system. At Waupun is the most short-staffed prison, and we're looking at a 53% vacancy rate, meaning more than half the positions are not filled at that prison, despite recruitment efforts that have been happening in recent years.
Is there any sense, Mario, that 50%, that's half, any sense that things are going to turn around anytime soon? Any grounds for optimism that there might be more staffing, which in turn might help end the lockdowns?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of discussion over the past year and movement to try to raise the wages for correctional officers. And some of that has been approved and is sort of underway, but it's going to take some time for that to recruit and hire additional officers. And there's no saying how soon that relief can be felt. In the meantime, I've heard from prisoners and others who are detained there that it's, you know, there are some weeks that are better than others, that sometimes it's been incrementally better, meaning maybe they get 2 showers a week, which they're by law required to have under normal circumstances. But then it's right back to 1 shower a week or perhaps no showers a week, no recreational opportunities. So it's quite hit and miss there still.
And you use the phrase by law there, Mario. Are there lawsuits happening or in the works over these conditions?
Indeed, there are. There is one attorney named Lonnie Story. He is based in Florida, but has taken cases here in Wisconsin. And he's filing a class action lawsuit on behalf of several inmates there. Among issues covered in the lawsuit, which will be filed in the coming days, are the loss of recreational opportunities, just the general conditions, the lack of timely access to medical care. So that is moving forward, and you know, there may be others down the road.
Mario, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Mario Caran, reporter for Wisconsin Watch and a New York Times local investigations fellow examining Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. He talked to us about lockdowns currently gripping several Wisconsin jails and prisons, in large part because of staffing shortages. Up next, we'll talk to a criminal justice reform advocate about how these lockdown conditions affect Wisconsin inmates, maybe some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, solutions you might like to see. And if you have an experience in the correction system as an inmate or on the staff, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about lockdowns in Wisconsin prisons, like the Waupun and Green Bay Correctional Institutions, how lockdown conditions are affecting inmates, and how the crisis might be solved. You can join in with your questions or maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa Luden joins us now, a coalition and relations advocate for the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
We just heard some of the basics of what's going on with lockdown. I understand, Melissa, you've worked with incarcerated people, have been incarcerated yourself. From the human side of things, how do these conditions going on for months affect inmates' physical and mental well-being?
Great question. From the human standpoint, I think one thing I would really like to point out is language does matter. And referring to people who are incarcerated as prisoners or offenders can exacerbate the problem or really try to bring that human component. So I think it's just important to recognize that these are still people, they're human beings, and that they're just currently incarcerated.
Yeah, and with that in mind, how are these months of lockdown affecting them as people?
I would say taking a look at specifically people who are in Waupun, in Green Bay, or have been to either, it's very taxing. It's very, I would say, hard for them mentally. I think many people still incarcerated are not necessarily even processed the lockdowns from when we had COVID-19 in Wisconsin. And being locked down to what Mario had indicated for 24 hours a day, not being able to come out, and maybe not to do laundry, have showers. The human component of that is just that takes a significant toll on a way a person thinks of themselves, That self-esteem already being in a system and a facility that is already very dehumanizing of that individual, this just kind of adds to that weight, as well as many of these people are not able to have visitation or have had to have visitation canceled. And so not being able to hug your child, your spouse, your mom or your dad, even if it was one time that they visited them a month, that human physical connection does take a toll on somebody's mental health. And I think we've seen, or I've heard of families who've traveled maybe hours to be able to go see a family member in Green Bay or Waupun, and then they find out after driving those several hours with that person's children that visitation had been canceled. So again, the weight even on the family of not knowing or something came up and they can't visit is just very traumatic and difficult.
As we heard from Mario, it looks like understaffing is a root cause of a lot of these lockdown conditions. Is it as straightforward as that, or do you think there's more to the story?
That's definitely a good question. I think Mario did a fantastic job talking about this, as well as the research he was able to put together. What I know is that staffing shortages go back to when we had Governor Walker in office, and he took the union away in Act 10 from the correctional staff, where the unions were still allowed with law enforcement and the fire department. You can see at that starting point, taking that union away, the trickle down of losing staff started to happen. I think at this point we've seen where, you know, correctional officers as well, they're not valued in this workforce, having to battle raises. I think having to work in very difficult situations where they're working maybe 16 hours for three or four times a week, I think explains the system as a whole, that if we're not taking care of our staff or really prioritizing how we can best support them, we're not going to take care of the people in the prison system. So I think it's really the tap above when you look at the system as a whole. Nobody is being taken care of.
Looking at the number of people who are incarcerated in Wisconsin, Melissa, we saw incarceration numbers go up over a few decades a lot. They've dipped a little, I think, during COVID, but not percentage-wise a huge amount. Is that part of the story here too?
I would definitely say, I think we know several years ago, and it's still safe to even say today, the driving force to mass incarceration in Wisconsin is still due to a crimeless revocation. Where somebody in the community violated a rule of supervision, which could have been a relapse or a missed appointment, is being sent back to prison. While that person may not necessarily be at Waupun or Green Bay, what's happening is we know that we have several people at Waupun and Green Bay that are not classified as a maximum level of custody, but a medium status that could move down to a medium unit if there was that space. I think we know there is some space. But if we take a look at, again, like I said, with that driving force, I know that the DOC has made some changes to not doing those revocations for somebody who has committed a rule violation, but we know that they're still happening and that it's still a significant problem.
Let's bring on a caller. Ronaldo is with us in Racine. Ronaldo, hi.
Hello, how are you doing? First of all, I wanted to say thank you to you all, trying to bring some light to this very, very big problem. I used to volunteer and go to the prisons and talk to the gentlemen, young men, older men, whatever, and encourage them. It became more difficult, and then they said, nope, you got to be a minister or a chaplain or whatever. And so then I got my chaplain license, and yeah, I went on to keep on doing that, to encourage. There's people who have not had a letter or a phone call from family or friends in many years. And when you lose hope, you lose everything. There's not much there. First point would be that I had a son that worked in corrections, and he was based in a tournament. He was a sergeant, and he was one, and he should have been at least four or five in that institution, but he was the only one there and had emergency, and he called out the ambulance. saved that young man's life. So, you know, we do have a shortage. He was...
Ronaldo, I'm sorry. We don't have a lot of time left. I gave us a couple points there. First of all, Ronaldo mentioned, Melissa, he went out and got a prison chaplain license to go. Not everybody's going to do that, but do you have thoughts on how to advocate for people who are incarcerated?
Good question. We have definitely a movement, I would say, in Wisconsin, particularly with people who are directly impacted and are very connected. You know, one person I can say in particular, Shannon Ross from the community, has a community newsletter that is pretty much spanned out to every correctional facility in the state through text behind, who's able to connect a lot of resources and updates to what we are all doing around the state. So for like reentry resources, who to contact maybe in what area that you're getting released, and just really motivating and powerful stories to keep the people in the prisons feeling hope and motivated. So one of the things I could suggest even in that is getting connected with the community, seeing how they can support that newsletter or providing Shannon Ross some things that can go in that newsletter. But overall, I think even with Expo and Free and what we're doing at the ACLU, just trying to be able to be of service and let people know ultimately, you know, people that end up in the prison system, they need basic needs.
Thanks to our guest, Melissa Luden, Coalition and Relations Advocate for the American Civil Liberties Union, talking about the impact of long-term lockdown conditions in Wisconsin prisons. Tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of nutrition ideas in the U.S. came from unlikely sources. Meet the Wisconsin author of the new book, Holy Food. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin is trying to get rid of materials like firefighting foam that contain PFAS chemicals by shipping them to a landfill in Alabama. We'll talk to two reporters about the practice and how people near that landfill feel about it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. And this is Central Time. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin State Senate Committee on Natural Resources made changes last week to a bill that would create a grant program to help local governments deal with PFAS pollution. The amendments would make it tougher for the DNR to require testing and cleanup from what the bill classifies as innocent landowners. PFAS, also called forever chemicals, have been found in water supplies around Wisconsin. High exposure to the chemicals is linked to a variety of health problems, including certain cancers and infertility. We're getting an update on that legislation right now, and in just a bit, we'll find out why some of Wisconsin's toxic PFAS waste is getting shipped to a landfill in a rural, largely black community in Alabama. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how things like firefighting foam and other PFAS-containing chemicals get disposed of, what it means for water safety? Is this an issue in your community? Do you work in a fire station or other place that has maybe some of these chemicals lying around and you're wondering what to do with them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Can you start by telling us about the core of this bill, this idea to grant communities money to help address PFAS pollution? What is the plan for this money?
Yeah, so it would do a variety of things. One big thing, it would establish a grant program for municipalities to address PFAS, and it would also set up a grant program for people who are considered innocent landowners. So it would help municipalities and landowners test for the chemicals in their water and wastewater treatment plants or wells, and it would also help pay for projects or upgrades to some of those facilities.
For the funding part of the plan, is there a sense that there is agreement among Democrats and Republicans that at least that part of this bill is a good idea?
Absolutely. I think that everyone agrees that there should be money thrown at this issue to try and address this problem. There's disagreement over how that should be done.
And then that brings us up to some of the most recent news that you've been covering, changes that Republicans on the Senate Natural Resources Committee made to this legislation. What came out of that?
Yeah, so if you look at the initial version of the bill and then at what has changed since then, there was an attempt to expand some eligibility for grants to privately owned landfills, and lawmakers also attempted to spell out who is considered an innocent landowner that's eligible for the money that's available under the budget, and they made some tweaks that would affect the DNR's ability to pursue enforcement action against anyone that's eligible for a grant under that innocent landowner program.
Can you talk about what that means for the DNR's ability to test for PFAS chemicals in some cases?
Yeah, so, you know, as part of the bill, it would limit the DNR's ability to conduct testing. They also wouldn't be able to prevent or delay projects based on the presence of PFAS contamination unless there's substantial risk to the environment and public health or other limited exceptions. But related to the testing piece, like, they could only do that under that program if they had probable cause to believe that it would exceed state or federal standards. And Democratic State Senator Dianne Heffelbein said she couldn't support the bill for that reason, because that wouldn't help when the state currently lacks groundwater standards for PFAS. And that's important because about one-third of state residents have private wells that draw from groundwater, so they wouldn't be required to test in that case.
What kind of concerns did Democrats on that committee and environmental groups raise about how innocent landowner would be defined and how the DNR testing might or might not work?
Yeah, I think the bulk of the concerns regarding this innocent landowner question is, will there be people who are eligible for this money that shouldn't be? There's fear from residents and environmental advocates that corporations who potentially caused PFAS contamination wouldn't be held accountable for cleaning up that pollution, and that that cost of that cleanup would be shifted to taxpayers. And then Democrats, again, voice concerns about limitations on the DNR's authority because they don't want to tie the hands of that agency to be able to address and clean up these chemicals.
Then on the other hand, a coalition of businesses, you write, Danny, including the group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, also opposed the amendments that changed some of the definitions here. Why were they opposed to that?
So they were opposed to the bill because it excluded manufacturers under these changes to the Innocent Landowner Grant Program. They wanted to make sure that businesses with property that's been contaminated through no fault of theirs to be eligible for those funds. And the way the bill is currently written, they say it's unclear whether businesses would be eligible for that money. So you have environmental groups saying it's too open-ended and could potentially provide public money to corporations, but then business interests say it's not specific enough to make sure that they can tap that pot of money.
There's still a long road to go with this legislation. Danny, what's next?
So the bill can now head to the full Senate for a vote, but it's not yet been scheduled as far as I'm aware, and lawmakers would have to vote on it there in the Senate before it heads to the Assembly. And if it passes there, then it would go to the governor, but Governor Evers' spokesperson hinted that it may be vetoed because they were disappointed with the legislation and how it turned out after months of working on the proposal with them.
Danny, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about amendments to a state bill that would create grants for dealing with PFAS contamination in communities around the state, but could limit the DNR's ability to require some testing and cleanup. Now, these PFAS chemicals are found in a lot of consumer and industrial goods, including firefighting foam. Wisconsin is currently trying to help fire departments get rid of foam, and much of it's getting shipped to a hazardous waste landfill in Alabama. The site is located in the rural, largely black community of Emel. A new story from Wisconsin Watch looks into how residents there feel about other states bringing their toxic waste there and concerns that it's a form of environmental racism. Bennett Goldstein is a reporter for America Corps, report for America Corps member, with Wisconsin Watch, where he covers water and agriculture. He's co-author of this story. Bennett, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com in Alabama. She's a former Mike Simonson fellow with Wisconsin Watch and WPR. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Bennett, let's talk about this key chemical that's part of the PFAS story, firefighting foam. When it comes to disposing of toxic waste like this firefighting foam, what kind of options do municipalities or airports or fire departments have?
Sure. Well, there are no federal requirements for disposing of PFAS because it's not considered toxic waste. So it's really left municipalities and states on their own to determine what they're going to do with it. So for instance, in states that have designed PFAS collection programs, some have decided to incinerate their foam. But the problem with doing that is it can release PFAS back into the environment if it's not burnt at a high enough temperature. And for those very reasons, some states have decided not to do PFAS collection. Like other states, like Colorado, for instance, paid fire departments to store their foam. And then like Wisconsin, other states such as Michigan and Indiana contracted with a hazardous waste landfill to store their foam there.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about Amel, Alabama, where some of that foam Bennett was just talking about is going?
Yeah, so Amel is in what's called the Black Belt region of Alabama, and it's a fairly rural, remote part of the state that is called the Black Belt because of the darkness of the soil and the richness of the soil. It was sort of the heart of American slavery and cotton production and is a mostly black area, mostly very poor area. And there have been issues there that have come to attention nationally and internationally in recent years about people's sewage systems not working and sort of basic fundamental kind of infrastructure issues that we take for granted in most of the United States. So Amel is a small town in the Black Belt, kind of near the Mississippi border, sort of southern central Alabama.
And you talked to local residents in the area, Sarah, and looked at the history of the hazardous waste dump there. Can you tell us a little bit about the controversy surrounding it from when it started before this PFAS was really a big issue?
Yeah, so like some interesting, I think, historical context is that this landfill was opened in 1977 by the son-in-law of then Governor George Wallace, who I'm sure most listeners will know as a strong segregationist governor from Alabama. And it was an era when the United States was first regulating waste disposal. And so it was sort of this burgeoning industry. And so Governor Wallace's family had the connections to open this landfill, and Alabama also opened several landfills throughout the state. It has one of the vast, considerably more landfills than any other state, and Amel landfill itself was pretty quickly like the largest landfill in the country. So it takes toxic waste, and there wasn't a lot of regulation back in the times when it opened, and a lot of local residents didn't know about it and didn't approve it. And then they kind of found out about it some years later, when some local activists kind of rallied around its presence and tried to sort of shut it down. And it became a pretty big issue in Alabama, gained some, attention into the 80s, Alabama being called like the pay toilet of America. And people were, had real questions about what it meant for those materials to be buried in the ground in a mill. And one of the reasons that the landfill said that they were placing it there is that there's a specific kind of rock in that part of the ground that is not very porous and supposedly protects the groundwater beneath, which supplies drinking water for much of the region. So that was how it got to Alabama and why the infrastructure is what it is today, where there are these kinds of toxic landfills in places like the Black Belt and maybe not in places like Wisconsin.
And Bennett, what do we know about the success of this facility in preventing leaks and how safe it is to store something like this PFAS foam in a facility like that?
Sure. So hazardous waste landfills are designed to last for centuries, and they do have a lot of safety mechanisms in place that your average city landfill would not. They have two liners and leak detectors and collection and treatment systems. And when liquids run through a landfill, and which is known as leachate, at a hazardous waste facility like Amel, they will collect it and then try to solidify it so they can rebury it. And like Sarah was saying, you know, because it's located above, you know, this area called the Selma Chalk, you know, the landfill claims that, it's only, and studies have indicated that any water that percolates through the ground is going to take thousands of years before it reaches those aquifers. However, I mean, the track record of this landfill facility is not perfect. And, you know, there have been violations documented throughout, the last, 30 or 40 years. For instance, you'll find containers in a recent inspection. Investigators found that there were containers that were rusting and damaged, and some were leaking. There's even a spill that investigators claimed had been uncleaned for roughly 2 years, and some of the floors that are designed to be impermeable to leakage were cracked. So, I think it, does go to show that these, systems are certainly not perfect. But at this point, there is no evidence to indicate that there has been contamination of groundwater due to the landfill or PFAS foam.
We're talking to Bennett Goldstein and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek about the reporting on PFAS chemicals being disposed of from Wisconsin by getting moved to a hazardous waste facility in rural Alabama, a small Black community there right next to the hazardous waste landfill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have questions about what happens to waste like this and the risks it can pose and how it makes its way from Wisconsin to Alabama? What do you think about the practice of shipping these chemicals to a rural, a largely Black community like Amell in Alabama? Is PFAS a story in your community right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sarah Weitz-Kotacek and Bennett Goldstein. They're two of the authors on a new Wisconsin Watch investigation into the state's PFAS disposal program that sends thousands of gallons of toxic waste to a landfill in Alabama. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your experiences maybe with PFAS in your community, in your workplace, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, you were talking about some of the early opposition to the hazardous waste site. In your piece, you talked to people about this recent news about Wisconsin PFAS headed there. A variety of opinions, it seems like these days, on the role, the value, the concerns about this hazardous waste facility and this waste coming from here in Wisconsin. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, I think like most of the residents I spoke with were somewhat concerned about living near this toxic waste. And they said, you know, we don't really know what we don't know. I met some guys in a restaurant who were saying they had heard that some new chemical was coming. And, you know, I doubt that they would have heard that PFAS was coming, but it sort of sounded like speculation. Whereas some people didn't really know that it was there. They were younger, maybe had grown up around it and just weren't aware. So it's been there for many decades now. And I think people feel somewhat, I think it's fair to say, resigned to it being there if they are concerned, aside from a couple of local landowners who own property next to it, which, and they've been kind of the most vocally opposed in public meetings, perhaps the only people who are still attending public meetings from the public about this. And I would say local leaders like the mayor of Amell, you know, he's kind of just said he was focused on his health and felt that there was really limited that he could do, and he's taking care of himself and health wise, but just felt like Amell doesn't really have the resources to test anything or see if there's a problem, and they're pretty, I guess, used to that mentality or way of life.
Bennett, I want to go back to the beginning of the story. You visited with the Jefferson Fire Department here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about what they were hoping to get rid of there? Set the scene for us.
Sure. So, I mean, they're, one of hundreds of departments around the state that have decided to get rid of their foam. And, when I was there, you know, the company that the DNR contracted with arrived and was able to just, you know, get out a forklift and a box truck and, you know, physically just remove, you know, rows of plastic pails of PFAS containing foam concentrate. And once it was loaded up, they also did a careful procedure where they would wash out the insides of the department's firefighting trucks that previously had PFAS foam inside of it. And then they would collect, you know, the water that they use for that. And then that also would end up in a vacuum truck. And eventually, once those materials are collected, they would all go to a centralized location in Wisconsin, and then would, once enough had been collected, would travel down Interstate 57 all the way down to ML.
And Sarah, this issue, you focused particularly on this one site in Alabama, but there are wider concerns that a lot of dangerous waste sites end up in low-income communities of color around the country. Can you talk about this as a wider issue?
Yeah, so we looked at a 2007 study that found that people of color make up 56% of the population in neighborhoods near hazardous waste landfills. And that gets higher at 69% when there's two or more facilities in the neighborhood. So there are a range of quality of life factors that go along with living near a hazardous waste landfill beyond whether or not the water, for example, is contaminated. There might be, you know, the anxiety or just the eyesore, property value issues. Some people say, you know, brings jobs to the community. Other people say it drives away other businesses. So it's a complex situation, but one that plays out in many poor communities of color in the U.S.
And Bennett, do you get a sense that in talking to, you know, state officials and others involved in this chain, that this is the end of the story? We're gonna find hazardous waste facilities. That's gonna end up where all the PFAS goes, and that's it.
I think it's really unclear what's going to happen, at least from my perspective. I mean, the DNR, you know, did what it was thought was, you know, is good for Wisconsinites. And I mean, there really, when it comes to PFAS, are very few options. And I mean, they were really, have spent years designing this program, trying to be responsible. And I just think that this case shows that even well-intentioned actions can have consequences. And but they have taken steps, you know, that do show increasing attention to issues of environmental justice. They hired a policy advisor last year who specifically looks at the DNR programming. And, you know, she told me that they're trying to, you know, better engage with communities that are impacted and to try to include their voices in decision making. So, you know, what that means in practice, I'm not sure. I would certainly love them to tell me. But I, you know, I think that this is a sign perhaps that these issues will be at the forefront when future state programs are designed.
That's the big question here in Wisconsin. And Sarah, at your end of the story in Alabama, what are you watching for next?
Well, we've had some discussion about whether it would be possible to maybe test some of the water in a ML, and you know, there's not necessarily reason to think that there would be an issue, but just to get that clarified. And you know, these landfills have been in Alabama for a long time, and I don't know that there's much legislative conversation about making a change on that front, but we're interested to hear more about the community reaction to our reporting. And, you know, have heard from some people about it. So curious to see if it starts some kind of public conversation.
Sarah and Bennett, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bennett Goldstein is a Report for America Corps member with Wisconsin Watch, and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com. They talked with us about their story on the hazardous waste landfill in Alabama that takes a lot of Wisconsin's PFAS chemical waste, and how residents there are feeling about it. You can find a link to the full story at wpr.org/centraltime or at wisconsinwatch.org. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.